Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaidyalingam, and today's interview is with Ben Steele, who is Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, and author of a new book called The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. Ben and I met in London in April 2013, and I began by asking him what motivated him to write the book.
Back in 2009, after the financial crisis went global, you had world leaders, people like Prime Minister Gordon Brown, French President Nicolas Sarkozy, calling for a new Bretton Woods. I figured it might be a nice idea to look at the old original Bretton Woods. And believe it or not, there really hadn't been anything done on the subject, not in terms of an historical narrative. In other words, how the sausage was actually made. There have been plenty of books on Bretton Woods as a system, but not as an event and an episode in history. And it turned out to be a more fascinating one than I'd even imagined.
And why do you call it a battle?
Well, the traditional account of Bretton Woods paints it really as a rather amicable collaboration between the great British economist John Maynard Keynes and this American technocrat Harry Dexter White, with 44 nations gathered to sort of coalesce around this framework. It was anything but an amicable collaboration. Keynes and White actually fought rather viciously for 2 years about the terms, particularly of the IMF articles of agreement, which were far more important to both sides than the World Bank, and they were very different visions. White, in particular, was a man who was, on the one hand, obsessed with the British Empire and the relative position of the United States and the British, and on the other, with the position of the U.S. dollar globally. I even found memoranda in his archives as far back as 1936, so this is 8 years before Bretton Woods, and only 2 years after he arrives at Treasury, at a time when he's really just a bureaucratic temp. And he's planning already for an international conference. And he writes, for example, the more sterling countries that will be around the table, the more powerful Britain will be when an international conference takes place. And he's determined to best Britain at this conference when it does take place.
So this was really, in contrast to the conventional wisdom, it was a real issue of real politique in a way, but in the battle between the two dominant countries.
Absolutely. Keynes, as you know, wanted to create a new supranational currency, which he would call Bangor, which he and the British hoped would rival the US dollar. And I should emphasize that this certainly wasn't Britain's first choice. They would have preferred that the pound sterling could maintain an important international role, but they knew that that wasn't going to last for much longer. So they were determined, in Keynes's own words, not to become, quote-unquote, a satellite of the United States. On the other hand, you had White and others in the administration who were very much anti-colonialist and were looking to exploit Britain's impending bankruptcy during World War II to, in essence, remake the global order. It's hard to fathom today, but they actually saw Britain as being the most natural geopolitical rival for the United States after the war, not, for example, the Soviet Union. And during the war, the U.S. was actually spontaneously more generous to China and the Soviet Union than they were to the British. So Bretton Woods was really part of a package deal, a Faustian bargain that Britain struck with the United States. The United States would provide Britain with short-term financial assistance through things like lend-lease to get through the war and a short transitional period after the war. This would be loans, not grants, parallels with the Eurozone today, in return for which Britain would agree to three things. First, to end imperial trade preference, the arrangement by which Britain gave itself privileged access to the markets of its colonies and dominions. This was anathema, of course, to U.S. exporters, but also to anti-colonialists within the FDR administration. Second, Britain would make the pound fully convertible again into dollars at a fixed exchange rate by a fixed date. That date was set as July 15th, 1947, a day that will live in infamy for Great Britain. This was a mortal threat to British solvency. And finally, Britain would accept the U.S. dollar as the global unit of account after the war. As you can imagine, this was not a bargain that Britain accepted happily, but as British delegate Lionel Robbins, a great economist in his own right, put it, at Bretton Woods, we needed the cash.
Give me a flavour of what the body of economic thinking was in the US around this time. How much influence had Keynes actually managed to achieve at that point?
Absolutely Keynesian. The United States, I think, has always been more Keynesian than Great Britain. This was imported lock, stock and barrel. You go through White's archives and you read his commentary on the domestic and international situation. You could put his words straight in the mouth of, say, Paul Krugman today. It was pure Keynes. White had none of Keynes' barbed eloquence, but the thinking was very recognizably Keynesian. I should emphasize, though, that White had a wider agenda that wasn't well known at the time. He was a man with deep interests in what you might call non-mainstream politics. He was a passionate supporter as a young man in the 1920s of fighting Bob La Follette's Independent Progressive Party campaign for the presidency in 1924 on a platform of ending U.S. imperialism in Latin America and nationalizing key industries. After he couldn't get tenure from Harvard in 1933, moves to a small college in Wisconsin where he's very unhappy, and he writes back to his former supervisor at Harvard telling him that he was studying Russian and he wanted to get a scholarship to study economic planning in Moscow. Over the course of his 12-year career at the Treasury from 1934 to 1946, despite being a staunch American nationalist who's determined to best the British and throw in the dollar as the unrivaled global currency, he is also a mole for Soviet intelligence. It is truly a remarkable story.
Today, at big international economic meetings like this, the top guys turn up with armies of advisors. I imagine it was very different around Bretton Woods. Can you give us a feel for what it was like?
White assembled his own private army of technicians, and they were extremely influential at Bretton Woods. White scripted the Bretton Woods conference very much as a kabuki play. There would be two major commissions, one which would be headed by him to create the IMF, and the second major commission was headed by Keynes to create the World Bank. White specifically put Keynes in charge of the World Bank commission to keep him away from the main event, which was creating the IMF. Within the commissions, there would be committees, which would be the talking shops. And these committees, White allowed foreigners to run. But this was just to give a semblance of participation. Because anytime there was a controversy, issues were referred to technical committees that were entirely controlled by White and his hand-picked technicians. In some cases, White used rather remarkable ruses to push things through that Keynes and the British had never accepted. For example, a placeholder term had been used in the draft, a joint agreement between the British and the Americans. It was gold convertible currency. And at one point during the conference, White had planned for this, an Indian delegate gets fed up and says, it's a high time that the Americans told us what a gold convertible currency was. White happily referred this to a technical committee, which duly went back and erased gold convertible currency throughout the 96-page agreement and replaced it with U.S. dollars. Keynes was told to sign the agreement as he was being forced to check out of the hotel, and didn't see this and various other provisions.
So how did the two protagonists of your book come away from it and thinking about what they'd been through there and what had finally been agreed?
Keynes was none too happy with the outcome, but he never gave London the impression that he had lost. His narrative back home was always that we, the British, had reached an amicable agreement with the Americans, and where it didn't look quite so good for the British, he insisted that there were sort of agreements under the table to take care of these things. Broadly speaking, Keynes was dissembling. There were senior civil servants in Britain, one in particular at Treasury, Sir Richard Clark, Otto Clark, very critical of Keynes and his being overwedded to this idea of, as he put it, a grand design. Keynes wanted to be known as the man who overthrew the gold standard and replaced it with something better, a rational, managed international system. He was none too happy with White's blueprint for it, but he always believed that that blueprint would eventually be overthrown and replaced by his. So Clark and others had argued that Britain should have walked away from Bretton Woods, could have borrowed the money privately, transitional assistance that it needed just to get through the war, the immediate post-war period, could have borrowed some money from the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which didn't have this geopolitical agenda, could have borrowed money from the Canadians. And in fact, there was a rear guard action against Bretton Woods by a group of New York bankers in May of 1944, just before the conference. They met with the British Financial Secretary in New York and basically offered him a deal. We will provide you with at least $3 billion in loans if you agree to walk away from this conference. They did not like the New Deal. They did not like the IMF, which they saw as the New Deal writ global, and they certainly didn't like the FDR administration. The British Financial Secretary was very, very interested in this and cabled it back to Keynes, who dismissed it with characteristic disdain. So he continuously lost his battles in Washington, but managed to convince the establishment in London that they should go along with it nonetheless.
You mentioned a current crisis and the calls for a new Bretton Woods. What does your examination, this exploration of the Battle of Bretton Woods have to reflect on that current conversation?
The reason we were able to get such a major agreement out of Bretton Woods is because one party held all the cards. We're talking about a dollar-starved world in the 1940s. There were only three ways you could trade in the 1940s. Barter, dollars, which only the U.S. government printed, or gold. And the U.S. controlled two-thirds of the world's monetary gold stock at the time. So the U.S. was able to offer a deal that the world could not refuse. That is, we will set up this new international body called the IMF, which will be primarily run by us, which will provide you with short-term financial assistance if you get into balance of payments difficulties, in return for which you agree not to devalue against the U.S. dollar without the connivance of this new organization. And the world really felt it had no choice, and it accepted this. It was better to have the fig leaf of the IMF rather than to have to go to Washington every time. Washington, meaning the U.S. Treasury, every time you got into balance of payments difficulties. Today, I don't think there's such a deal to be struck. Compare the creditor-debtor relationship between the United States and Britain during World War II with the creditor-debtor relationship today between China and the United States. We in the United States use the same language to describe the problems in the world's monetary architecture as Keynes and the British did in the 1940s. Because we in the United States are in the same situation. We are now the world's largest debtor nation. A few years ago, former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner proposed that there should be caps on persistent current account surpluses. This is pure Keynes. These are the ideas that Keynes brought to the table in the 1940s. Needless to say, the Chinese don't accept this. They say it's the fault of the profligate debtor nations. This was the language that the United States used in the 1940s. But China doesn't have nearly the leverage over the United States today that the United States had over Britain in the 1940s. For example, in Suez in 56, the Eisenhower administration was able to push Britain out of the Sinai by threatening to provoke a sterling crisis, withholding aid support from the IMF. It could do this at no cost to itself because American holdings of British securities were trivial, amounting to about $1 per U.S. resident. Today, of course, China has massive holdings of U.S. dollar-denominated securities amounting to more than $1,000 per Chinese resident. So if China were to try to provoke a dollar crisis to get the United States to change its behavior, it would be hurting itself at least as much as the United States, at least in the short run.
That's the U.S.-China comparison with U.S.-Britain then. Well, any reflections on how we can learn from this period for the Eurozone financial crisis?
Yes, I would say that Germany is behaving towards the south of the Eurozone very much like the United States behaved in the 1940s. That is, we will trade you loans in return for conditionality, various structural reforms. Now, the structural reforms that the United States demanded of Britain were perhaps very extreme by the contemporary standards of what's going on in the Eurozone, but the parallels are there. The world did not particularly appreciate the U.S. approach in 1944, but it had no choice. Likewise, the south of the Eurozone today doesn't have any viable choice as it sees it to accept German terms. But I should emphasize that this approach in the United States that we took in 1944 was completely overturned just 3 years later through the Marshall Plan. The IMF was totally mothballed by the Truman administration. It had no role in the 1940s and indeed most of the 1950s. There were sort of three foundations of American Bretton Woods thinking. First, that the British Empire could be peaceably dismantled, which is clearly false. Two, that Germany should be dismembered and deindustrialized. And third, that the Soviet Union could be permanently co-opted into an alliance. 3 years later, Marshall Plan says, no, Britain is not a geopolitical rival of the United States. It's a desperate ally that needs to be bolstered against an imminent Soviet communist threat. Germany does not need to be dismembered and deindustrialized, quite the opposite. It needs to be rehabilitated and turned into the industrial engine of a new integrated Western Europe. Western Europe being an American conception, not a European conception. And finally, the Soviets needed to be contained and could not be co-opted. And the world reacted very well to the Marshall Plan in a very different way than it reacted to the Bretton Woods framework. The world saw the Marshall Plan as being magnanimous, a form of enlightened intervention. My feeling is that Germany, at some point, sooner rather than later, is going to be forced to transform its loans into grants. It may as well get credit for it by being magnanimous, by presenting it more as a form of a Marshall Plan. That is, we're not going to continue to pile debt upon debt. And we understand that certain debts are going to have to be forgiven, simply recognizing necessity, but in return for which all of us are going to undertake structural reforms like banking union that will help us ensure that we don't get into this situation again.
Ben Steele, thank you very much.
Thanks for talking with me.